Right. So I'm calling this talk, When Meditation Is Not Enough. This is inspired by an article. I don't know when it was published. I think it might have been recently. It's in Lion's Roar. And I think on one of my teacher's lists, they sent it around. And I thought it was really interesting. And it was by Ama Tanasanti. She's a Theravadan Buddhist practitioner. It says, why meditation alone can't heal every wound. So I'm just going to read a little bit from the beginning to set the stage or the talk. So she says the names of certain individuals have been changed to protect their privacy. She says, I once knew a monk, Ajahn Kamaso, who could sit in perfect stillness for hours, disciplined, warm, respected. Decades of meditation had deepened his capacity for loving kindness and focus. People trusted him completely. But he also carried trauma from his years in combat. When nightmares, panic, and fear began to resurface, he turned to his teacher, Ajahn Kemavaro, a highly regarded master known for his deep realization and insight into emptiness. Students came from around the world to learn from him. The teacher's response, snap out of it, you know how to meditate. Perhaps he meant, you've got this, but that's not what landed. Several months later, while on Tudong, a period of wandering meditation practice in Southeast Asia, Venerable Kamaso left his robes folded neatly in his room with a brief note and climbed out a third-story window down the outside the building and walked until he could send a telegram to his teacher informing him that he was no longer a monk. When we spoke a year later, I asked Jeffrey, his name is a layman, why he had left like that. He said, if I had seen Ajahn Kamavaro, I would have punched him. The ferocity in his eyes and tone underscored his words. Facing his teacher had become too much to manage skillfully. So her article doesn't go into a lot of detail, but she mentions, so she had spoken to Jeffrey, and then 6 months later, she was at his memorial. So I'm guessing that he took his own life. So she wanted to, write this article. She says, my working hypothesis is this. Realization and healing are not the same thing. Meditation cultivates awareness and insight, but it doesn't always address three distinct and often overlapping domains of wounding. Trauma, attachment injury, and narcissistic wounding. So I'm going to talk a little bit about and give you her descriptions of each of these things. And my purpose in talking about this today is one, to invite each of us to consider whether we have some of this, either any of these, have some of this unfinished stuff, unhealed stuff, and or whether other people in the Sangha might, not that we're analyzing them, but just recognizing, they may be suffering with some of this, injury or trauma. So not only to recognize that, but also to expand our idea of practice beyond. So when I say meditation is not enough, in a way, we're not just talking about meditation, we're talking about all the aspects of our practice, which essentially point us toward the absolute realm of like emptiness. Like there really is no one here. And, dukkha is just caused in a way by your attachment to wanting something to be different. And so you can let go and then the suffering will end. And so it's kind of that, those obviously very important and often very, those aspects of our practice can help a great deal, right? They can help us break free of self-limiting stories, and they're very fruitful. But they're not always the medicine, right? And if we can expand our idea of practice, which I will be talking about in what ways, I think we have a much, much better chance, each of us, of achieving true happiness and peace, and as a Sangha, creating a environment that is conducive to that, so that we don't end up, not that I think we would, but, you know, that we don't end up being the kind of place that would say, well, just get over it, right? When somebody is dealing with trauma or something. So these are the three areas, and I'm just going to read the very short description that this author gives for each of these areas. And I'm not saying that I necessarily, I'm no expert in any of this. I'm not saying they're necessarily exhaustive, but they're very thought-provoking. So she says, first is trauma, the body's unfinished story. Trauma is the residue of uncompleted survival responses. What was too much, too fast, or too overwhelming for the nervous system to process. When the system is flooded and outside its window of tolerance, the first thing to go offline is the capacity for observation. Regulation must come first. Awareness can follow. Without this, just observe can unintentionally re-traumatize rather than heal. So sometimes, you know, this is the whole, like, just sit and be aware of your body, or even follow your breathing. Like, it's just like not is a contraindicated for people in certain stages of agitation surrounding trauma. The second is attachment wounding, the pain of disconnection. Attachment wounding arises when early relationships lack consistent safety, attunement, comfort, delight, or encouragement. It's not about a single event, but an enduring pattern of unmet emotional needs. What heals attachment wounding is not insight, but relationship. Experiences of being met, seen, and valued in ways that rewire the nervous system's expectations about love and safety. And then the third one is narcissistic wounding, the subtle defense of self. And this is actually a psychological term, narcissistic wounding or injury, but it's not like it. It's obviously negative because it's injury or wounding, but narcissism, it's just talking about the self, and that, like, this is somebody who received narcissistic wounding might end up with narcissistic personality disorder, but that's kind of like an extreme version. And there's a spectrum of this for most of us. So she says, narcissistic wounding arises from the loss of contact with our essential being, our innate sense of value and authenticity. This disconnection creates a painful emptiness that the personality tries to cover over with self-images and external validation. Ordinary narcissism is part of this universal human struggle for self-worth and cohesion, while narcissistic personality disorder represents a more entrenched and rigid form of the same wound. Even with direct realization, either form of narcissism can persist because it's woven into the fabric of the personality. Realization transforms awareness. It reveals who we truly are beyond self and story, but it doesn't automatically rewire the psychological and relational patterns that formed to protect against shame, inadequacy, or rejecting. So I looked it up. So emotional trauma of feeling shamed or disgraced, particularly early in life, overwhelming a person's sense of pride and self-worth, it can stem from a childhood experience of insecure attachment where vulnerability was dangerous, or from later events like public criticism, creating a deep-seated fragility, often resulting in disproportionate reactions, or coping mechanisms. Sometimes it's manipulative or contemptuous or defensive. It's, to protect the fragile ego. So in Tanasati's article, she was really focused on what happens if a teacher doesn't address these things, right? And they have realization, but then they still have this stuff. They can cause a lot of harm. And she talks about how like a whole dysfunctional community can form around a narcissistic teacher or whatever. So, and that's very important. But today I'm focusing more, like I said, on us, on our Sangha, on practice. So I like the phrase that she uses, though: meditation alone cannot heal every wound. So it can be a valuable and important part of our practice, just not necessarily alone. So in a way, if we expand it to, because I thought I was kind of going to name the talk like practice can't heal every wound. But if we really expand our idea of practice to consider everything we're doing to take care of our lives and cultivate wisdom, then, psychotherapy can be practice, medication can be practice, working on our relationships can be practice. So in a sense, practice can, if nothing else will heal the wounds, then practice. But it's certainly true that formal Buddhist practice, like Dharma studies and meditation and Sangha stuff, like the, capital B Buddhist traditional stuff, isn't necessarily going to deal with every wound. But what's beautiful is how it might be easy to think about this as some of us end up with these wounds or incomplete, development, and therefore we have to take care of this stuff in order to do the practice, right? We kind of like how to do this preparatory work. We got it. But the beautiful thing is it's not really like that, right? It's really much more integrated. Like the whole question of healing the self and the nature of the self is every bit as profound wherever you are on this spectrum of woundedness. And maybe even if you have that, if you do have some trauma, if you do have some injury, that might be your Dharma gate, right? You might really, in working with that, in exploring that, I might teach you an immense amount. So let's just deal with each of these three things. So trauma, she says, regulation must come first, awareness can follow. So it's important in terms of trauma for us to learn how to distinguish between ordinary challenges in Zazen and kind of extraordinary ones. So ordinary challenges in Zazen, I mean, everybody has a little pain. Everybody has a little dullness and drowsiness. Everybody has, wandering mind. And sometimes we're worried or excited or something, and the thoughts are kind of intrusive. So meditation isn't easy. But it's kind of a matter of degree. So if you sit and your mind just gets stuck on perseveration of like the whole time you're sitting there. I mean, if something just happened, right? Like if something upsetting just happened, then it's not surprising that you might be sitting there and like just kind of mulling that over. But if that is pretty much defines your Zazen, right? Kind of no matter what your day was like, no matter how recently something happened, it's just if you're experiencing trauma, it's just kind of a re-experiencing of the trauma physically and mentally. If you're depressed, it can just be the mind just making arguments for why everything sucks and why you suck. And then it's not restorative. And in fact, in a way, maybe you're just actually making things worse because you're just giving yourself even more time to just sit there and perseverate. And also the results. Like I know people who have been depressed or dealing with serious things, and they just know that sitting is not helping. Whereas most of us, it feels like, feel a little better today for having sat, right? Even if the sitting didn't seem that great, just feel a little bit more sane. So the tricky thing is that no matter what your state of trauma or depression or anxiety, Zazen usually will be somewhat helpful. So it's, you know, not necessarily just like you necessarily don't want to do it at all. And you don't want to be excluded from the practice. But it's important to accept our karma, if that is part of what's going on for us, to really face it, set aside narratives, and then embrace other aspects of our tradition, of which there are many. There's like many things that can be meditative, chanting, you know, calligraphy, copying sutras. Sometimes people find doing walking meditation is more helpful. You know, you may find things of your own that tend to do a similar thing to Zazen, right? In just allowing you to reset, allowing you to just momentarily let go of all worrying about all that stuff and just be. Directed effort meditation practices may be beneficial, following the breath. Sometimes not. Sometimes people find they can disrupt the perseveration by doing something like that or doing metta practice. But also, you know, avail yourself of cognitive behavioral therapy, or I've heard really amazing things about eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, EMDR, which is this, like, you're asked to remember the traumatic events, and then like you do this eye movement stuff, and it's like your brain is reprogramming itself with relationship to these memories and experiences. And I had a Soto Zen teacher said she got in a really scary accident on the highway, like full speed, like, you know, and she was fine, everybody was fine, but it, like, just that, you know, just when she was driving or she went near that spot or whatever, she was having all of these, you know, post-traumatic experiences. And she went and she had like one session of this and it was just gone. So anyway, I haven't done it myself, but I've heard really good things. And then just in terms of like accommodations in Sangha, which is something that I really want to talk about. And there's, I don't know all that much. So if anybody is like, does deal with PTSD or complex PTSD or whatever, and you want to add anything, or you could send me an email too. But one of the things that I know is very helpful for people who deal with this is the freedom to come and go. Like a sense that, you know, if something gets to be too much, you can leave. And a sense of things being predictable, of things being like, there's no, you know, crazy surprises. There's a nice schedule and it's clear what's going to happen. And apparently like clear signage. Okay, this is where I need to go and this is what's happening. I'm not saying all people, but so in terms of tying this to like kind of the deeper aspects of our practice, this is one of my favorite books. It's called Trust, Realization, and the Self in Soto Zen Practice. And this is an academic text put out by the Institute of Buddhist Studies. And I think it costs about $50. I don't even know if it's in print anymore, by Daijaku Kinst, but it's very beautiful. And let's see. So I wanted to share something on. So she's brings in psychology into this book, and she's a Soto Zen teacher. And so she's really like, how can these inform each other? How essentially her central point is like, how can we make Soto Zen better and more sensitive to what we're learning in terms of psychology and developmental psychology and stuff like that, to make Soto Zen practice places, teachers and sanghas and whatever, more conducive to practice, you know, and avoiding that issue like we read about in this article. So this is one that made me leap to my mind when I was thinking about trauma. So I guess there's this concept of cohesion. Cohesion is a term used to describe a self that experiences the I am I as a unified and historically continuous self. This may seem out of place or counter to the Buddhist understanding of dependently co-arisen self that emerges moment by moment. But if we think of cohesion not as the definition of a static entity, but as a description of a flowing process, difficulties with the use of the word cohesion to describe the self disappear. So they talk about based on experience of awareness and an observation of the content of that awareness, there is a visceral sense of personal continuity in the midst of clearly observed flux. So this is a description of like a healthy psyche. Visceral coherence then is an experience of the continuity of awareness independent of the content of awareness. And it is quite different than the narrative coherence constructed through stories. Narrative coherence, based as it is in the complex nature of a multifaceted self, that's more criticism of the narrative coherence. The experience of coherence in the self can be understood to include the historical perspective, the sense of an I am I, that emerges from lived experience, but is also not dependent on it. Cohesion of the self can be envisioned as less like a story with a beginning, middle, and end that hangs together well, and more as an ongoing process that evolves to include many dynamic aspects and many stories. So this is she talks about developing this sense of self, and it needs to be, we need to, in order to open ourselves up to teachings or practices that may challenge our sense of ourselves, we have to have a basis of trust, right? That even if it all kind of goes like this, it's all going to kind of come back together, right? Like you can open yourself up to a kind of transcendent experience, and then Domio will be back here for, you know, so she can brush her teeth in the morning, right? Like, and really there's things like trauma and other kinds of mental illnesses where that sense of coherence of self is not as easily trusted, right? People really have experienced a breakdown, and then they really don't know where to turn. So the emphasis is, and I think is one of the wonderful messages of her book, is that our practice needs to encourage that coherence of self. Not the, you know, not the narrative part, but it's a different thing. We have to trust ourself in a way. We have to trust that it will be here, and that we can kind of trust our sense of intuition and right and wrong, that we can rest in it, or we will not be able to open up to the deeper teachings. And we're not trying to destroy that self. We're relying on that self. So that's where, did I already say? Yeah. I went to go hear a talk by the Dalai Lama I gave to Portland once. And the one thing I remember is he said, you have to have a strong sense of self to do this practice. And of course we know he doesn't mean a sense of arrogance, a sense of attachment to your narratives, right? But a strong, healthy sense of self. So then going into these other things, well, let's see, there was another part I said, 125, trust in the self. A person who has developed a reasonably cohesive and robust sense of self will be able to be present for a wider range of experiences. With a coherent self, experiences and affects are seen more as signals of a changing self state rather than as indicators of impending psychological disorganization and fragmentation. A fundamental feeling of worth, a sense of continuity, the belief that the self will continue to be able to provide a coherent and useful organization of reality, even under stressful conditions. So then we get to attachment wounding, right? This, if for whatever reason, personality, early life experiences or something, she says, what heals attachment wounding is not insight, but relationship. Experiences of being met, seen, and valued in ways that rewire the nervous system's expectation about love and safety. So this is one that it's very easy to misunderstand in Buddhism because, you know, everything is empty and we're supposed to let go of attachments. And we're not supposed to depend on other people for our happiness, especially not on what they think. And so there's a real, you know, monks left their families and all of that. So there's this kind of de-emphasis on relationship. Like, yeah, you got to go out there and have some relationships, but that's, you know, not really the practice. But then, of course, we also have the fact that the Buddha said, you know, good friendship is the whole of spiritual practice. Not half of spiritual practice, the whole of it. And there's this, you know, a lot of emphasis on Sangha and on trust of the lineage. So for various reasons, it seems like Americans tend to be, I don't know, are we more wounded than previous generations? Or I don't know. But people seem very wounded. People do, like, we're very defensive and it's difficult to trust. It's difficult to really open up and rely on people. You know, it's a dicey situation. Anyway, she talks about three things Daijaku Kintz does that I hadn't been aware of. These are in developmental psychology. These needs that we have as development of developing human beings. And the first is mirroring. Let's see. Won't read too much, but just her. Mirroring. A child needs to be seen, to be mirrored in such a way that she is looked upon with joy and basic approval by a delighted parental self-object. Being seen in this way is the essence of the mirroring experience. Then we move on to idealizing. Idealizing self-object relationships describe the need of the growing child to have a consistent and reliable relationship with another who they can experience as strong, competent, warm, respected, and caring. Someone who provides safety and is admirable. So describe these things. Many of us can think of, like, oh yeah, well, not so much. Or we know people who didn't end up experiencing this as much as they should have. And then finally, or not finally, but the these major three is twinship. The dimension of self-object relationships expresses the need to experience oneself as fundamentally like others, with similar and shareable desires, experiences, and affective life. So when we start to have a sense that we are like this person, and they are like us, and we can understand each other. So, you know, this opens up a lot of beautiful, she talks a lot in this book about how in sanghas we can provide this for one another. And so I just invite you to think imaginatively about that. I like to think that we do a decent job of this, that we, you know, try to get to know one another. In our term student program, we share our life stories. And my experience of the term student program is really like, wow, I am not alone in that, right? And you realize, oh, wow. So that kind of twinship, like, people are not fundamentally different from me. I look at the outside and I may think you're like this, and I may think you really got it together or something. And you realize everybody has their stuff. Everybody's working. That just I think she's talking about Sangha here. She says, because she has a whole chapter on the practice environment. In a supportive practice environment, the practitioner's experience will include some sense of being deeply and meaningfully responded to by his teachers and fellow practitioners, with recognition, encouragement, and even joy at his participation. This may not always take an obvious, outwardly expressed form, but it is found in full inclusion in the practice and the emphasis on the teachings that all beings are Buddha nature. And then the idealization, like, in order to go deeply into practice, we really have to trust. We have to trust that, like, the teacher kind of knows what they're talking about, that the ancestors do, that this practice was designed to be supportive. You know, we have to be able to trust that. And then finally, just briefly, in terms of narcissistic wounding, you know, I feel like this is a spectrum, you know, narcissistic personality disorder being on the far end, all of us being somewhere in between, of just like alienated from our own, you know, self nature, of feeling, you know, confident in who we are and feeling authentic and feeling worthy. And I feel like in our practice and in our sangha, we can really be, we have a wonderful opportunity to be working on this. We can be patient with one another to begin with, like recognizing this is something people may be working on. And in terms of like how realization may not take care of this, I have witnessed firsthand, you know, I've seen people who have had dramatic Kensho experiences, just like, oh, they just, this perspective shift, and they saw the true nature of self, and they remained extremely insecure and fragile. Like, I don't understand. I mean, I'm like, but didn't you see? But that's just like she said, if you, you know, if you have that deep-seated, that's how you're wired, for whatever reason, you know, early experiences, that realization isn't just going to fix that, that insecurity or those coping mechanisms that we may use to protect the self. So we also have to do this work of gradually letting down our defenses as we learn to trust, right? This is, she talks about how this practice environment and a sangha and a teacher and a tradition that you can learn to trust allows you to slowly but surely, you know, let down your defenses and coping mechanisms, etc., and realize our Buddha nature. We are neither better nor worse. I mean, most of us, I think, kind of flip between. Sometimes we're like, I think I'm a little better, but then it can flip to the other. And I am worse. I'm worse than, you know, your average person, whatever that is. So yes, we can do mirroring, idealization, and twinship in the practice environment. And she talks about basic trust and absolute trust. She said basic trust is this kind of, you know, human level trust. And this is what allows us to develop absolute trust, which is trust in ourselves. She describes this. Let's see. Basic trust provides the foundation on which a reliable and cohesive self is built. It is essential to the inclusion of a wide range of experiences and the welcoming of alternate ways of understanding that experience. Reciprocity and mutuality form the foundation of relational life, and a full and generous engagement with others and the practice becomes possible. With the establishment of this trust, it becomes possible to relax in states where subject and object are not so easily defined, and open to a new experience of subjectivity. In Zazen and other dimensions of her practice life, a practitioner is able to trust not only that the self will reliably reconstitute itself and that sufficient relational support is available, she will also come to experience trust in life itself, that is absolute trust. This evolution of trust allows the leap, so to speak, to be made from a sense of self that is bound up with a view of reality based on notions of self and object, self and other, to one in which dependent co-arising forms the foundation of experience. All right. Open that up. Comments and questions. Hopefully that wasn't just too, I don't know.
Thank you, Domio, for this.
Yeah.
Medical researcher from Harvard, his last name is Benson, in the 60s said, we come into this life with cell memory. And on that level, we can recognize schemes that are what we need in terms of general health, right direction. And I like to think Buddha, nature, you know, that's part of that for every person, no matter what their background or circumstance is. And generally speaking, I have friends who worked in finance, and we're not a society of trust. In fact, I hear in the news, you know, all in all, so many people say, oh, I'm not voting anymore. Why would I? And we're not even doing that now on a high percentage, less than 40% of eligible people. So to me, why not, you know, go with winners? I mean, something that we have has been around for eons for us in this life, something like Buddhism. That's a format that's open, really, for the least amount of input. Well, anyway, thank you for this. And I've done Rapid Eye. It works. Certainly, I've seen people that thank you for this talk.
Yes. Thank you, Ruthann. Jinryu.
Excuse me. Thank you, Domio, for the talk. I really enjoyed it. Just a thought and a question. The first thing that came into my mind as you were talking about the teacher's reaction to the monk and his the monk's concern. I'm not trying to excuse it by any stretch of the imagination. It was harsh in my view. And frankly, not well thought out. But what I always tell folks is that teachers are human. I mean, this teacher, he may have his own detachment disorder, or attachment disorder. So everybody, even the people that we put on pedestals, have a right to be wrong. They have a right to call the shots badly. And that to me is an opportunity for me to question who I trust and who do I talk to, as well as I don't know what I was going to say next. But it's everybody's got karma, everybody's got their stuff, as you mentioned in the talk, and that includes our teachers and our leaders. The other thing I was going to ask was, maybe you were talking around it, but I didn't hear a whole lot about mindfulness. And I know in my own case, and I am not a good practitioner of mindfulness, but I try. And I know that in those moments, when I do try, my head will clear. And to me, clearing up my mind is a big step toward understanding myself better and healing myself. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
I agree. I mean, and I got a sense from this story that, like, wasn't like that guy left his teacher because that one comment. Like, I got a sense like the practice environment as a whole was not giving him any options. And honestly, like, it's tricky. I've seen it in many communities. I'm not aware of it in ours, but in a way, as the teacher, I'm gonna be blind to it. So I have to rely on y'all to let me know. But in one of the things, for instance, that trans and non-binary people are experiencing in Zen communities is sometimes like, gender doesn't matter. It's empty. This is just a narrative you're telling about yourself. Right? So like then their whole like everything that they're exploring and needing to deal with is kind of discredited. And there's a truth to that, right? There's a truth in the way that we're like, the true self is no self and all that. And, right? Abby.
Right. I really appreciate you giving this talk because I've been around the block a few times with a few different religions, and this is the first time that I've heard anything like this be addressed. I am a survivor. I have done EMDR and it is fantastic. I'm making a plug for dialectical behavioral therapy. It's actually based on Buddhist concepts. And the creator of DBT was able to take Buddhist concepts and transform them into skills that people with narcissistic injury and complex trauma and abandonment issues can then learn to use to live a more balanced life. Her name is Marsha Linehan. She's still alive. She lives in Seattle. And she still gives talks on it. And I like on the one hand, I grat like I hear what you're saying about Zazen not being all the only way to healing. And I would agree with that. But I will also say that Buddhism as a whole has helped me to take a different perspective to my trauma and my healing process and has helped a lot.
Are you willing to say a little bit about that? Like how? I mean, you don't have to. I'm just,
Oh yeah. No, so
I mean, kind of like what did it add to, the other
yeah.
things that you were trying, you used?
So I will preface this with, everybody's trauma is going to be a little bit different. For me, Zazen forces me to take some time to take care of myself rather than giving all of my energy to everyone around me. It also, like, seeing, like, acknowledging the Buddha self, and trying to achieve the Buddha mind, has, it gives me something that I can work towards rather than just trying to forget all of my trauma, because my trauma isn't going to go away. Buddhism has helped me to kind of look at things different so that I can better accept what's happened, and learn to live as a whole person in spite of what's happened. And it's helped me to kind of accept the lack of control and the powerlessness that I had in certain situations. And to kind of also take some of the power away from the people who perpetrated what they did. Like, yeah, it's, yeah, this has been a good journey for me. And like, it's not everything in terms of healing, but it does help.
Yeah. Thank you very much for sharing. Anjo.
My thoughts are a little disorganized. I'll try and sort them out. It might not work. There's a lot of meat in this talk, all three of those. And I want to say a fourth thing, which is possibly unhelpful, possibly helpful. It is, if you have a karmic bundle that has left you trying to fix yourself because you conceive of yourself as broken, or trying to build resilience because you conceive of yourself as weak or fragile, healing can be a viciously sharp knife you use on yourself. If you sanctify that idea that there is some better you must reach, that can actually be a really horrible thing to do to yourself. And it can really alienate yourself, alienate you from yourself. So just, in the spirit of not always so, hold that word healing gently if you can. I'm still learning to do that.
That healing could be used as a weapon on yourself. No. Thank you. I mean, that's it's the beauty of our like our dual aspect practice. That we do try to work on this phenomenal self, meaning phenomena, not really super. We do work on this phenomenal self, take care, face our karma, accept, heal, da da da, but also simultaneously working on this opening up to this ask this truth about ourselves, which is that, yeah, there's absolutely nothing wrong. It's like, I don't know. I guess what leaps to mind is the story of the ugly duckling, right? Just like think there's something wrong, and then you realize, oh, this is fine. I'm totally fine. I've been fine from the beginning. Although that's not, you know, the whole beautiful swan thing, right? Implies that like we discover we're really the beautiful swan. But what we actually discover is like, I don't know, when we step back and we see it all through a different lens, all of our struggles and attempts and incompletenesses and limitations or something are just like, how else should they be? They're, I don't know, I think of it like, you know, when we read a story, we watch a movie and we see a character and they, you know, the character doesn't think they're perfect. The character does, you know, it's like, oh no, I got this thing and this terrible thing happened to me. But from this view, you're just like, wow, what a fascinating story. You know? And such is our lives as well. All right. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha.
All Buddhas throughout space and time. All honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas. Wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita.